Hi, this is Tanzina Vega, and I'll be with you on the Takeaway Podcast all of next week. Until then, here's Todd Zwillick on the mic for today's show, The Takeaway for February 9th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. Could you sense it while you slept? A brief, fleeting, almost ethereal government shutdown. The federal government was technically in a lapse during the wee hours, but Congress passed a bill reopening the government early this morning, then the president signed it by breakfast. The shortest shutdown ever. One for the record books. Did America miss its federal government during those 8 hours and 39 minutes? Kind of makes you think. Well, the latest spending fight is over, but what to do about the DACA program rescinded by President Trump isn't over. Immigration activists in the Capitol demanding legislation to protect undocumented immigrants who came here as children. Democrats have been promising to force a fix using a government shutdown or any other means necessary. So far, though, no deal. Where does this leave Democratic politicians with a key constituency of their base? And then there's Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, at the head of a GOP conference with a restive nativist column embedded inside of it, and a president promising less immigration, not more.
I know that there is a real commitment to solving the DACA challenge in both political parties. That's a commitment that I share. To anyone who doubts my intention to solve this problem and bring up a DACA and immigration reform bill, do not. We will bring a solution to the floor, one that the president will sign. We must pass this budget agreement first, though, so that we can get on to that. So please know that we are committed to getting this done.
Well, there's a March 5th deadline for 690,000 undocumented immigrants currently protected from deportation under DACA. The Senate is set to take up immigration next week. And then the question after that, can Paul Ryan deliver on immigration and pass a bill that President Trump would sign that could get 60 votes in the Senate? Joining me now is Erica Andiola, a DACA recipient herself and former press secretary for Senator Bernie Sanders. Erica, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. Also back on the show, Elise Foley, immigration reporter for HuffPost. Hi, Elise.
Hi, Todd.
Erica, let me start with you. You have watched the back and forth in Congress, promises from Democrats to use their leverage over government spending to force a deal on DACA. They don't have it yet. The government is now funded again. Do you think, Erica, Democrats have broken their promise?
I mean, definitely. And you know, this is not the first time we saw that they literally got into a shutdown and they didn't have the ability or the will to get DREAM under those circumstances when they had all the leverage in their hands. And so it's definitely frustrating for us. And it's something that we keep in mind as we move forward. And it's just tough because at the end of the day, Trump did end DACA, and Trump at the end, he has a lot more power, and the Republicans have a lot more power at this moment. So, you know, it's disheartening, and the fact is that DREAMers and people like myself and many others are, you know, in limbo and could be in worse situations if nothing gets resolved.
Elise, a very, very brief shutdown in the dark hours of Friday morning that's now been resolved, and a couple of weeks to go before this DACA deadline. Where do things stand right now?
So as of right now, we have sort of a framework put forward by the president. It took him a while to actually do that. But what he's demanding is that he will help DREAMers, and he says that he'll help about 1.8 million people if he gets some sort of border security measures, including his wall, if he gets to change policies so that he can more easily deport other kids who come and asylum seekers, and if he gets to make these massive cuts to legal immigration. So that's kind of where the White House has laid down its markers. In the Senate, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, has said that he'll have sort of an open process so that senators can put forward different things. So what's likely to come out of the Senate, if something comes out of the Senate at all, will be something that might not at all look like what the president wants, because there's opposition to some of the things the president wants. So you've got, you know, potentially the White House's plan, then you might have a Senate separate plan, and then in the House, you have various proposals that have been put forward that Paul Ryan, the Speaker, has not allowed a vote on up to this point. And he'll have to either determine whether to have a vote on a potential Senate bill, to have a vote on one of the bills that's already been put forward, or to, you know, potentially do nothing at all.
Erica, where do you think this might be headed? A big budget deal has passed that delivered $130 billion in domestic programs that Democrats really, really wanted. Do you think Democrats' leverage is gone, or do you think that enough people are demanding a fix to DACA that it can still get done?
I mean, I would say that, you know, the fact that, yes, Democrats definitely, you know, lost a lot of their leverage, or if they had any power, right, given that Republicans have the majority in the two chambers and the presidency, still, to me, you know, the fact is that more than 80% of Americans support the DREAM Act. And so it's really right now, it has gotten tougher, because the fact is, if this goes to the House, more and more people in the House, especially Paul Ryan, who wants to pass something that will be signed by the president and, you know, that the president wants in the first place, that could mean that they want something that's going to be terrible for the rest of our communities. And, you know, we've said it over and over again within the Dreamer movement that we don't want to be used as tokens. We don't want to be used as bargaining chips to get terrible policies that are going to hurt the rest of the immigrant community and future immigrants. And so, you know, it's looking to me, you know, and to a lot of us, it's frustrating because it's looking harder and harder to get something that is clean, something that is just going to address, you know, the DREAM Act, which is what Americans, you know, really support without having to have anything else added to it.
Elise, Erica's looking forward to a debate in the House and whether Speaker Paul Ryan can pass a fix to the DACA program along with everything else that Republicans want. I wonder if you see a risk here that Paul Ryan won't be able to produce in the end. Is it possible that along with DACA and all the other things that Republicans want, more border security, a wall, curbs to family immigration, legal immigration, that it won't be able to bridge the gap? You know, the president is representing a base that's nativist, and it seems like there might be nothing Paul Ryan could pass in the House that could also pass the Senate. What do you think?
I think that that's a very, very real concern. And that's the reason that a lot of Dreamer activists and a lot of immigration reform activists wanted it attached to a must-pass bill, because they wanted, like Erica said, a clean DREAM Act. So something that wouldn't include all of these other measures, because then it would have to go through. Ryan would have to allow a vote on it because they would need to pass the bill for other reasons. So I think there's a very real risk that it gets so piled on with other things that are controversial with Democrats and even some Republicans, especially these legal immigration cuts, that it just dies, and that what we have in the end is Paul Ryan saying, "You terrible Democrats, you didn't vote for our very reasonable bill that would, you know, give some Dreamers legal status, but also allow us to deport a bunch of people and build a wall, et cetera, keep out, you know, legal immigrants." And then the president blaming Democrats, and then Democrats blaming the president and blaming Republicans, and then nothing actually happening. And if that is the case, then really the best hope for Dreamers would be future legislative action, and then also the courts, for them to continue blocking Trump's rescission of DACA. Because at the moment, we should note, people are currently allowed to apply for DACA renewal, which changes the dynamic a little bit, but only because of a court ruling.
Erica, Democrats seem to be hoping that if something doesn't pass by the March 5th deadline or at all, that they'll take an issue to the election that would bring Latinos out to vote for them. You mentioned 80% of Americans approve of the DREAM Act, and maybe now Democrats think that if Republicans can't pass something that they would agree to, that it'll be a great issue in 2018. Does that ring true for you?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been true for many, many years, to be very honest with you. And that's part of why it's so difficult to deal, at least within the immigrant rights movement, to deal with the Democratic Party, because basically their take on trying to get Latinos on board to vote for, you know, in the elections is, we're your friends. We're the ones who support undocumented communities and immigrant families, and Republicans are the enemy. But the reality is that we have had to push Democrats all along, because, you know, they just use us. They use us, and it's easy to use us for their elections. But at the end of the day, they don't really want to get this resolved, because it's a great way to use us as a way to win more and more Latino electorate around the country.
Well, look, Erica, we all know that that's part of politics, except it's a part of politics that's tough to stomach when actual lives are in the balance here. I wonder what your prediction is for 2018 if a fix for DACA doesn't pass.
You know, I think, you know, as part of a bigger movement, right, I am a dreamer. I've been part of the immigrant rights movement for many years, but I'm also part of a bigger progressive movement, and I was part of the Bernie Sanders campaign, and I do really believe that this is the moment and this is the year to also primary Democrats. We need to make sure that in those states where there's those moderate Democrats who are so afraid of doing anything on immigration because they think they're going to be voted out, that they get primary by candidates who, you know, go out there really running for really as populist candidates who are not necessarily afraid of talking about immigration, but they're also addressing issues that are that matter to working class people.
Elise Foley, given what Erica has to say there, throw it forward to the Senate debate next week. If the Senate can pass an immigration bill with a DACA fix and some other things in it, does that mean that people should rejoice? Is that going to be the end of the story?
No. If the Senate passes something, they still have to get through the House, and then it still has to get through the White House. And even at that point, I think that, you know, Erica can speak to this as well, but I think that there are a lot of immigration battles still to come, because even if something happens that helps some dreamers, not even all people who came to the U.S. as children would necessarily be eligible for that, and certainly not all of the undocumented community. So there's also people who came as adults who've been here for 30 years and have children here and things like that, who the immigrant activist community wants to help as well. So this fight is not going to be even close to over if the Senate does pass something.
That's Elise Foley, immigration reporter at HuffPost. Also, Erica Andioli, a DACA recipient herself, former press secretary for Senator Bernie Sanders. Erica, Elise, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been 5 months since three hurricanes tore apart portions of the United States and islands across the Caribbean. One tiny island nation was probably the hardest hit of them all.
The island of Barbuda was once a Caribbean paradise. Now it is lost.
Hurricane Irma ripped into the Caribbean island of Barbuda on Wednesday, leveling almost every structure.
In Barbuda, houses underwater, cars floating through the streets.
Takeaway producer Rob Gunther has been following the recovery on the island and brings us this report.
Barbuda suffered a double blow. First, Hurricane Irma hit, and with Hurricane Jose looming just off the coast, the entire population, all 1,800 people, were forced to evacuate to its sister island of Antigua.
The house that I lived in, which is a family house, that was completely blown away. Nothing there. It's literally just down to the foundation.
That's Ray Beezer. She's a Barbudan school teacher, and she remembers what it was like that day.
Evacuating Barbuda, I was a bit skeptical because I didn't really understand why, but then I was made to understand that a next hurricane was in the path of Irma and it was going to hit Barbuda. So on top of the fact that Irma literally came and destroyed, the next hurricane would probably wipe us all out.
They're two separate islands, but Barbuda and Antigua exist as one country. And yet the storm and its aftermath have exposed lingering divisions between the two, as Barbuda struggles to get back to where it was before Hurricane Irma.
What I didn't understand was why we were left in Antigua so long and not able to come back to Barbuda. There's still no electricity, still no running water.
People are frustrated. They've always felt like they've existed in the shadow of their larger, more prosperous sister island. Now, as some Barbudans are trying to rebuild their community, they're facing what they see as an inadequate government response.
My name's Dakota Jeffrey. I'm the president of Barbuda Relief Network, founded out of necessity, a direct response to the storm. Myself, I'm of Barbudan heritage. My parents were born there, as well as my grandparents.
From his home in Miami, Dakota, as well as others with ties to the island, have sought to take matters into their own hands, raising funds, sending teams to begin needed repairs. But their teams weren't prepared for the extent of the destruction.
Well, our first project on the island was a 52-day rebuild initiative that we put together. Once we got on the ground, we realized that the cleanup had really not progressed.
Where was the government during this time?
Well, as far as the government's response to the storm, When we got there, we were told that quite a bit of cleanup had already taken place, which is kind of why we put together our mission as more of a rebuild. The response as far as the cleanup, in my opinion, you know, it was a bit lacking.
The challenges that remain extend far beyond basic cleanup.
Well, I would say the biggest obstacle would be the restoration of vital services, electricity, running water. The bank is still not open. There's not even an ATM on the island currently. You know, people that have children, their children have to go to school. So, you know, obviously we would need those things restored in order for the greater population, you know, to return to the island.
Currently, no public schools are operating on the island.
I think that's totally disrespectful and ridiculous.
That's where Beezer and her team have stepped in.
The children of Barbuda have the right to be educated where they live. They don't live in Antigua. They live in Barbuda. It just upsets me because the Ministry of Education has failed.
In lieu of government intervention, Beezer and her two colleagues started their own learning center in Barbuda to accommodate the children who returned to the island.
On the first day, we registered over 40 children. And then the next day, the Friday, we registered again over 15 children. That is over 10% of the school population in Barbuda. So that just goes to show you how many parents have returned and said enough is enough. We're going back to where we live.
It's been a struggle.
That's Sir Ronald Sanders. He's Antigua and Barbuda's ambassador to the United States.
And the reason for that is that the hurricane damaged over 90% of the structures on the island. We had to evacuate every living soul from Barbuda and move them to the sister island of Antigua, which is where most of them have been since the hurricane occurred on September the 5th.
So what accounts for the slow pace of getting residents back home?
Well, if we're looking really at the question of getting the Barbudans back to the island, the question is getting them back to what? And that can only be to their homes, but those homes are structurally damaged.
But Ambassador Sanders dismisses any notion that the government is somehow dragging its feet or trying to discourage Barbudans from returning home.
Now, that's a nonsensical argument because it's costing the government $3 million a month to pay for the people who are from Barbuda to exist on Antigua. That's $36 million a year.
The government seems to have a long-term agenda, but from day to day, we do not know what is taking place.
That's Bishop Nigel Henry, who has reopened his church on Barbuda for weekly services. Bishop Henry is more forgiving of the slow recovery.
You have to understand that this is a 62-square-mile island. It is only inhabited by maybe, let's say, 2,000 people. The income towards the national purse is nil, very limited, and most of the island have not been insured. That becomes a problem.
Barbudans don't have homeowners insurance, and that's because Barbudan society doesn't believe in home ownership. For over 100 years, they've operated on a principle of communal land ownership.
Well, the myth has existed amongst the Barbudan community, and it is one that they have perpetuated for over 157 years. That Barbudans owned the island of Barbuda in common, and that they received this island from a man called Sir Christopher Codrington, who was at one point the governor under the British government.
As the story goes, Codrington leased the island from the British Crown for the price of one fat pig a year. In 1870, he gave up the lease, and today residents and the government disagree about who actually owns the land. But now that the island is in need of capital, the government is trying to get residents to accept deeds to individual plots of land, the idea being that this land could be used as collateral for loans to rebuild their houses. It's an idea that's not sitting well with many Barbudans. Again, here's Dakota Jeffrey.
The pushback to that is many Barbudans are saying, why do you need a deed for something you already own? And they're feeling as though, you know, for 300 years, this land has just been communally owned, passed down, and so on. And the controversy over the land is hindering the recovery efforts because, I mean, in a time like this, it's really counterproductive to be dividing the efforts. All the efforts should be focused on the recovery first.
Now, how I see it is, you do not talk about land when people have just lost everything.
Ray Beezer again.
That is the last thing you should be talking about, land. I see this as the opportunity for the government to now come in power to try and take everything from Barbudans.
Bishop Nigel Henry validates Ray's fears.
Barbudans have always been skittish about the fact that Antiguans are out to take the land.
There's still many challenges ahead, as a majority of residents have yet to return to the island, and with a timetable for a full recovery still uncertain. But leaders like Bishop Henry have faith that Barbudans will ultimately persevere.
My messages have been on hope, that we're looking towards the future. We're letting go of the past. We are trying to build not only a sustainable Barbuda, but sustainable personal lives. Those are the main themes that I'm holding towards right now.
For The Takeaway, I'm Rob Gunther.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Another conversation now on addressing sexual harassment and gender in America. What can men do to help advance the cause? We brought that question to Koa Beck, editor-in-chief of Jezebel, and Jessica Bennett, gender editor for The New York Times. Every week, they share their thoughts on a different piece of this moment. And this week, we asked them to reflect on some of the ways that they think men can be real allies right now.
Koa, so I know that we actually each brought in lists of things that men can do.
We sure did.
Talk to me about male allyship. How does one be an ally? What are effective strategies and ways that people can jump in?
So I would like to note that my list is informed by actual conversations and experiences I've had with men in my life. And a lot of times this is a variation of what I have told them. So the number one quality in a true male ally is listening, not waiting for your turn to speak, but truly listening to the experiences of people who have been violated and harassed, and actually being present in what they are saying. Come in with the understanding that you may not be the closest to this issue. Absolutely, men can be victims and have been victims in this conversation, but just come into this with the understanding that you may not understand this. Next on my list is being willing to unlearn a lot of cultural conditioning you've learned about courtship or how to interact with women. I think what we need is not only men who think critically, but men who are willing to unlearn those things and assess them for what they are and assess them as a problem.
I think these are really important. I also like to try to provide concrete in the moment things that men can do. Because listening is one thing, but jumping in when you see something going wrong is another. And so I think disruption, you know, if you see something that looks out of place or that looks like the woman is uncomfortable, jump in. Bystander intervention is so important. Do you remember that story about the guy on the New York City subway who became known as Snack Man?
I missed
this. There was some sort of confrontation happening. I'll explain. I love Snack Man. There was some sort of confrontation happening on the subway, and people were getting in a fight. And this guy had a box or a tube of cheddar Pringles, and he decided to stand in between these two people in the middle of their confrontation and just eat his Pringles. And it was the perfect silent intervention that got them to start. And somebody was, of course, taking a video of this. It went on YouTube. It went totally viral. But that, to me, is a perfect way of intervening. He didn't even have to say anything. He just stood there and separated these people. So I think intervening can be really important. You know, if you see something happening in a workplace, confronting the harasser after the fact or confronting the perpetuator after the fact, people witness this stuff all the time and they don't do anything. So maybe you don't feel comfortable confronting the person who is doing the harassing, but what you could do then is talk to the person who is the victim of it. Are you okay? Something as simple as, are you okay?
And to actually talk to the victim as opposed to reassigning the victim. In a lot of workplaces, the common tactic when somebody has gone to HR and reported sexual harassment is that the person who has been victimized will just be reassigned. They will be sent to another department.
To get away from the harasser, as opposed to getting rid of the harasser.
The harasser, which actually we just saw in the Times reporting on Hillary Clinton and what happened in her campaign, and that the harasser reportedly stayed in exactly his position, whereas, you know, the young woman who came forward was sent elsewhere. And that harasser harassed somebody else. Surprise! Even though we're seeing a cultural shift around victims being believed within Me Too, overarching across all of this, believe victims who come forward and say things. This is anecdotal, but even just on a small level, I remember when I was in my early 20s, this just came back to me while you were talking. I was walking along the Astor Place area, and I became aware of the fact that a man was following me, and he had been following me for blocks and blocks and blocks. And I wasn't really sure what to do. It was like early night. So I remember ducking into a Starbucks just to surround myself with as many people as possible. And I remember getting in line to sort of protect myself and be around other people. And then I remember getting to the cashier, and I didn't really want anything. And also being 23, I was very resentful that I had to buy something because I was being followed. And I remember getting to the cashier and thinking, like, I could just buy something, or I could tell this man that I'm here because another man is following me. And so I opted to do that. And I said, I actually don't want to buy anything. I think that I'm being followed and I'm scared. And he, without even questioning me, he just looked at me and said, there's a door in the back, I can take you. And I mean, that was incredibly meaningful to me because he could have looked at me and said, you have to buy something, or
I don't, like, see anyone following you.
I don't see
you.
Anyone. Yeah. But he just immediately believed me. And then he shuttled me out the back door and I got home safely.
I also think these are all spokes of a larger problem, which is culture that is institutionalized to value men. So when we think about male allyship, I wrote about this a lot in my book. Like, what are concrete things that men can do on a day-to-day basis? Not just in a sexual harassment scenario, but in a regular scenario. All right, well, things like giving women credit for their ideas. Mm-hmm. Women's ideas are less likely to be correctly attributed to them. And even if you're in a mixed gender setting and a good idea emerges from the group, people, both men and women, are more likely to remember that idea as having come from a man.
Right.
Because much like what you were talking about, Kobe, these are things that are ingrained in us. Mm-hmm. You know, we, since the beginning of time, have been taught that it is men's voices that are leading. It is men's voices that are important. So unlearning some of those behaviors, you know, you can do simple things like interrupting an interrupter. So
yes,
we talk a lot about women's voices not being heard. Women are twice as likely to be interrupted when they speak as men are. So women and men can do this. But if you see someone being interrupted, you can be like, hey, can you let her finish? As simple as that.
My favorite thing to do in the interrupting conversation, which I've been across a lot, is Jessica wasn't finished talking.
And then more broadly, I always think about this as supporting companies that have women in power. All of these problems need to be dealt with on a day-to-day basis, but structurally, we know that organizations that have more women in leadership are less likely to have sexual harassment problems. They are actually more effective. They actually are better economically. They bring in higher returns, every good thing you could possibly think of, and they're generally more inclusive. So what can we do? Sort of what we spoke about a few episodes ago about putting your money where your mouth is. Support companies that support women, whether that means working for them or supporting them with your dollars.
Jessica Bennett is gender editor of the New York Times and author of Feminist Fight Club, speaking there with Koa Beck, editor-in-chief of Jezebel. You can hear all of their conversations on our website at thetakeaway.org/MeTooMemos.
The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Where the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
The torch has been lit at the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. So we're going to check in on hockey now, one of the biggest sports for Team USA. Kate Cimini has covered a lot of hockey in her day. She's currently a freelancer for The Athletic Chicago. Kate says one of the biggest things you have to know is that the NHL is not taking a break. And that means that some of the top male players in the world, Alexander Ovechkin, Sidney Crosby, you name it, will not be on the ice.
It definitely gives Russia a better opportunity to get higher up in the rankings. Well, I guess we could say Russia, not Russia, right?
Right.
Since Russia can't really field a team this year. But overall, I think for North American fans, it's going to make the game more personal. They'll see players who maybe, you know, younger fans went to college with or are in college with. I know that the U.S. is fielding players who've been playing in the KHL. It's Russia's answer to the NHL. It's just going to be a very different game. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of Miracle on Ice references just because of the quote-unquote ragtag group of college players.
But Kate, what was behind the NHL's decision in the first place not to pause the league for a couple of weeks so that the world can see the very best hockey players on the ice?
Oh, money. The NHL loves its money. They're a business. You can't really blame them. They wanted the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, to pay for the players' flights to and from. The IOC, and I believe also some stipend for the time off, the IOC said no, and the NHL was absolutely not going to pay for that.
Well, let's talk about hockey on the women's side. Team USA has a long history of back and forth with Team Canada, and all too often Canada comes out on top in those matchups. What does the USA have to do to advance and to win in 2018 here?
Oh, that is such a big question. The USA is, there's such a strong team, and it's been very interesting. If you go back and you look at the records of the previous matchups, literally, I think after US won the gold in 1998 Nagano Olympics, the US has won gold in Four Nations, in Women's World Cup. Canada keeps coming in second, and then Canada pulls out all the stops at the Olympics. The U.S. is typically, the past couple of iterations have really been a start-of-the-game team. They're really strong in the first and second periods, and they taper a bit in the third. Whereas Canada, typically a little weaker in the first, start to gain strength in the second and the third, and that's usually just when they finish off the U.S. in the Olympic competitions. So this is going to be a really tough game. I think the U.S. is going to try and make it physical and speedy because that's their skill. And I think Canada is going to try and really just hold off the U.S. until they manage to get somebody like Marie-Philippe Poulin fired up so she can just sing a couple of shots in.
Meanwhile, Kate, let's look at the host country and their team just for a moment. A little bit of ice hockey diplomacy on the women's side, because South Korea and North Korea are going to be joining into one unified team on the ice. Maybe it has diplomatic implications beyond the Olympics, but how's the hockey world looking at this?
Oh, not too favorably. First of all, I believe the head coach for South Korea, she was not even informed by the government. She was informed by the media. The players themselves were pretty taken aback, pretty angry. There's kind of a sense that the North Korean team is just piggybacking on all the hard work that the South Korean women have been doing. Although, to be fair, the South Korean women are, they're ranked 22nd in the world, and only the top 7 or 8 teams get to play in the Olympics. But the host country gets an automatic bid. So, I don't know, 6 of 1, half dozen of the other there.
Plenty to watch on the ice at the Olympics. You won't be watching NHL players on the men's side. You'll be watching a very motivated USA women's team and a little bit of diplomacy on ice for the Koreans. Kate Cimini with Athletic Chicago. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's stay on the ice now in South Korea and hear from someone who's soon to be flying over the blue line for the women of the USA. Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson is a forward and a veteran of the U.S. national hockey team, and we reached her before she flew off to Pyeongchang for her third Olympic tournament.
There's a small group of us, there's 6 of us, that this will be our third crack at it, and so I try to be a veteran on the team, but young at heart, just because the younger players bring a lot of youth and energy.
Veteran on the team, but young at heart. You're 28, right?
Yep.
The younger players see you as, I don't know, great aunt. What is it like at 28?
Well, it's, as you kind of grow up through this program, it's I think our older players have continued to get older, but you just try and enjoy every single opportunity that you have to play with this team and to put on the Team USA jersey. But I think the younger players kind of look at a couple of us older players like grandmas. We go to bed early, we wake up early, we enjoy our morning coffees, but I think when we get in the locker room, we like to have our own fun.
Now, no one knows what's going to happen in the Olympic tournament, of course, but I think a lot of people are expecting a USA-Canada rematch, probably in the final. Team USA beat Canada in the World Cup last year, but over the last 6 meetings, it's Canada 5 wins, the USA just 1. How much of Team USA's planning, conditioning, practice, off-ice planning is geared toward Team Canada?
I would say there's different drills that may be geared towards their style of play, but we definitely try to focus on ourselves, and we want people to adjust to our style and our game and our speed instead of the other way around. But we obviously understand that Canada, you know, in the history behind playing them and that they're a great team. And so we just have to be prepared to play our best game. And we feel confident that if we do that, we'll be successful.
Well, Jocelyn, let's go off the ice just for a minute, because you were on the show just about a year ago. And that was when Team USA threatened to boycott the World Cup to protest unfair wages. The team has a new contract now. I wonder how you're feeling about that, and also how the rest of the team is feeling having gone through that confrontation and come out the other end.
I think at times we almost didn't realize how monumental the spring was for us, our team, for women's sports, for gender equity. And so whenever it comes up, I think, you know, it's a good reminder to really, you know, feel proud about what we were able to accomplish. But on the day to day, I think we show up to the rink and, you know, we're prepared to go to work and get better every day. And it's a work in progress. We're able to accomplish a lot with a contract, but it's also continuing to implement those things that we asked for and make sure that we're continuing to move in a positive direction with USA Hockey and promote women's hockey and promote girls' hockey and try and grow the sport. And this year is an instrumental year in doing that. To get girls in front of world-class game is special. And it's, I remember when I was in, I think it was fifth grade, I went to the U.S. was playing the University of Minnesota in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And my mom took us to the game. And so those are opportunities that I remember having during Olympic seasons. And so it's definitely something that we have to remind ourselves that was pretty special, but it created a trust within our locker room that I don't think would be there any other way.
Well, the team negotiated hard for that, Jocelyn. I would imagine that a great Olympics on television in prime time across the United States would probably be one of the best things that you guys feel like you could do for the development of girls hockey.
The best thing our team can do for the development is to go win a gold medal. That's for sure. If we can do that, it'll definitely change drastically in this country as far as more eyes on the sport and more parents hopefully watching and more girls saying, I want to go do that. I want to play in the Olympics one day.
Well, we're all going to be behind you. We're all going to be watching, and I can't wait to see that speed off the blue line. Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck in South Korea. That's Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson, forward for Team USA. Thanks for being with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and as the Olympic Games get underway in South Korea, the action on the ice and on the slopes is not the only thing to watch.
We will not allow North Korean propaganda to hijack the message and imagery of the Olympic Games. We will not allow North Korea to hide behind the Olympic banner the reality that they enslave their people and threaten the wider region.
Vice President Mike Pence in Tokyo on Wednesday, a stern message for North Korea, backing up the sometimes bellicose rhetoric of fire and fury coming from the commander-in-chief. But from South Korea, the country potentially with the most at stake here, a very different diplomatic tone. On Saturday, South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to meet with a delegation from the North, and among those delegates is Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong. It's the highest level contact between the two Koreas in decades. Sung-yong Lee is professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Professor Lee, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you might call this summit built around the Olympic goodwill that's been manufactured between North and South Korea here. But what's the message behind having Kim Jong-un's sister meet with the president of South Korea as opposed to some other official from North Korea?
First, to soften up North Korea's image and to exude this softer image and buy a free pass for the next provocation. What I mean is, you see now North Korea reaching out to South Korea, changing the atmospherics in the region to one that is much warmer, while the United States is playing catch up and doing this rather clumsily, I might add. Vice President Pence is saying the right things, but things that don't need to be said. For example, that he's going to South Korea to prevent North Korea from hijacking the games, that this is all a charade, that North Korea is a prison state that tortures and starves its people. All this is true, but in saying so, the United States comes across as the Grinch, as the grumpy party pooper even. And the same applies to Prime Minister Abe of Japan. While North Korea comes across as the genuine peacemaker or the party seeking peace. So this is one snapshot of North Korea's capabilities in wielding the carrot as well as the stick. We tend to underestimate North Korea, laugh at North Korea, but they are very crafty in both the game of belligerence and also placating South Korea.
Is there something special from North Korean political culture that would be interpreted by the South Koreans by having Kim Jong-un's sister meet with the president rather than a foreign minister or some other appointee?
Well, North Korea is a dynasty. It's a family regime. There have been only three leaders, the founder, the son, that is the late father of the current leader, and this third generational leader across the last seven decades. And I guess it's almost universal to have some kind of morbid fascination, curiosity when it comes to royalty. South Koreans have been cut off from North Korea over the past seven decades, and South Koreans are very easily excited and even, dare I say, mesmerized when North Korea puts on a softer face. And in sending Kim Yo-jong, the sister of the North Korean leader, North Korea has already transformed its image. It comes across as softer and even more glamorous. And that is in South Korea's interest in the short term, because South Korea will try to build on this brief rapprochement and to re-engage North Korea and to relax sanctions against North Korea and take the driver's seat in North Korea policy away from the United States. It is a bit ironical. 30 years ago, when South Korea put on the Summer Olympics, North Korea cravenly tried to spoil the games by blowing up a South Korean civilian aircraft. South Koreans were quite angry and sensitive. 30 years later, South Korea is far richer. Its status in the world is much more attractive and stronger. Yet South Koreans have become more dependent on the abuser, on North Korea. The more menacing North Korea behaves, the more threatening North Korea is, the more beholden, dependent on North Korea's goodwill, South Korea is.
So that's the substance on offer here, in your view, Professor, with these high-level meetings around the Olympics. Not some agreement on the table, but an opportunity for South Korea to play a more prominent role in its relationship with the North, and those moves that you've talked about on this show before, an opportunity for North Korea to drive a wedge between the South and the United States.
North Korea has already won several small victories in that regard. Yes, the wedge is there, palpable, quite visible. And for North Korea to conduct another nuclear test or launch a satellite into space, thus testing its ballistic missile capabilities right in the middle of the games, it would be an ideal time to do so. And I realize it sounds far-fetched, but if North Korea were to do something like that, or even shoot off an ICBM right in the middle of the games, what would the Trump administration do with thousands, tens of thousands of foreign visitors all assembled in South Korea? Threaten war, preemptive strike? I don't think so. North Korea would be able to walk away scot-free. And this crescendo of goodwill in the Korean Peninsula, I am certain, will spill over even into the post-Olympics period in April, May, June, July, and so forth. So already North Korea has won a free pass for its next provocation, which will come.
Talks around the opening ceremonies of the Winter Games on the Korean Peninsula, potentially yet another round from North Korea, isolating the United States. Professor Sung-Yoon Lee, Professor of Korean Studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Always good to have you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, that's all for us today. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.